Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order March 3rd, 2009. We have an interesting agenda today, and we'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 2598. I'll invite Representative Galizio and Representative Greenlee to join us, please. While you're getting settled, Barbara's on her way back. Perhaps she can give us a little summary, please.
HB 2598 establishes a 13-member Human Cell Research Committee in the Department of Human Services, requires the governor to appoint the committee and delineates its representation, term length, and other administrative rules, directs the committee to develop guidelines for research involving derivation of use of human stem cells and to report guidelines to the Legislative Assembly, the governor, and the Oregon Health and Science University, directs the committee to study the nature of informed consent that should be provided in conjunction with human stem cell research, establishes the Human Stem Cell Research Grant Fund, authorizes the committee to seek private and public contributions for the purpose of funding research grants from the fund, continuously appropriates money in fund to the committee, defines the crime of human cloning, prohibits the use of human eggs or human sperm donated for the purpose of assisted reproduction to create human stem cells for use in research without obtaining the consent of the donor, allows the Department of Human Services to impose civil penalties to violators of this act in addition to other penalties imposed by law, appropriates funds from the general fund to the Department of Human Services beginning July 1, 2009 for the purpose of providing administrative support, declares an emergency, and makes the act effective July 1, 2009.
Thank you very much. Representatives.
Thank you, Chair Reed and Vice Chair Benz and members of the committee. My name is Larry Galizio, and I'm State Representative for House District 35, which is Tigard and unincorporated Washington County and a little bit of southwest Portland. Appreciate the opportunity, and I'm honored to be joined by our good colleague, Representative Greenlee, and I think we spoke, and I'm going to lead us off, and then Representative Greenlee will talk. I would like to just begin by saying that, there's a lot of discussion on this particular topic, and we're going to be continuing the discussion today, and I hope we have an informed and rational and intelligent debate. So I appreciate the opportunity. We had a bill last session that was similar to this bill, but I think this is actually a better bill. In speaking to some of the scientists at OHSU and other people, and so that's the hope. So first, what I'd like to do is just explain a little bit about what the bill does, and Barbara did a great job. I think this bill does three main things. Number one, it will create a stem cell research committee made up of scientists, medical ethicists, and members of the public. And they will examine the medical and legal and ethical issues related to stem cell research and, importantly, develop guidelines for the research conducted here in Oregon. Secondly, it creates the Stem Cell Research Grant Fund in the Department of Human Services, and it will authorize private and public contributions to help facilitate stem cell research here in Oregon. And third, the bill does recognize that even as scientific technology advances, there are activities that are simply contrary to our shared values, and so the bill specifically outlaws human cloning in Oregon. Today what you'll hear, or some of what you'll hear, is what I hope are many compelling reasons to support the House bill. We have testimony from research scientists from OHSU, and I really appreciate them taking the time to come down. And we'll also hear from a constituent who is courageous enough to come down and talk about his personal experience dealing with some of the, one of the debilitating diseases that stem cell research is hoping to mitigate, if not eliminate. Also, you should have a letter, or you will receive a letter from Roger and Karen Anderson, They were not able to come today.
We have that.
You do have that. Okay, good. Talking about living with Parkinson's. And I also want to draw your attention, colleagues, there's a letter, or you either have or will have a letter from Dr. Bruce Goldberg from DHS talking about there. Couple questions, or I want to sort of preempt. One question might be sort of why do this now? Here we are in the middle of a recession. Times are tough. First and foremost, I think that as policymakers, we have a moral imperative to advance research that we believe could, you know, restore millions of people with debilitative disease or who have sustained traumatic injuries. I feel like we just have that moral imperative. And then secondly, as we are in sustainability and economic development, this is an economic development bill. We are fortunate to have Oregon Health and Sciences University, and bioscience research and development and technology transfer is actually is critical. It's growing, and in research and development, the ability for scientists to work together collaboratively, go to conferences, and then share the research, it's very important. So making investments in those types of bioscience research, I think Oregon can be at the forefront, and we have a really interesting niche there. Finally, there are some amendments, or there's a Dash 1 amendment that you probably have or will have, and number one, the Dash 1 amendments will... They define human cloning. They clarify the responsibilities of the research committee. And they also will reduce fiscal impact by specifying that the members of the research committee will serve as volunteers. So before I turn it over to Representative Greenlick, again, this is a contentious issue. At the same time, it is a bipartisan issue, especially at the federal level. Orrin Hatch of Utah, Republican, Arlen Specter, former presidential candidate John McCain, Oregon Congressman Greg Walden, all support stem cell research. And as does First Lady Nancy Reagan, who of course had to experience firsthand the debilitating disease of Alzheimer's disease that former President Reagan had. And I just wanted to quote from Nancy Reagan, who at a conference for juvenile diabetes said, quote, "There are so many diseases that can be cured or at least helped. We've lost so much time already, and I just really can't bear to lose any more." So with that, colleagues, I appreciate the opportunity to hear the bill. Glad to take any questions, although the scientific questions should probably go to the scientist. And I'll now turn it over to my chief co-sponsor, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mitch Greenlick. I live in Northwest Unincorporated Multnomah County. I'm a professor emeritus and past chair of the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at the medical school. And incidentally, I'm a member of the House of Representatives from House District 33. I introduce myself that way because I'm here testifying, actually, in all three of those roles. My role as a citizen, my role as a professor that spent 40 years of my life bringing scientific discovery to the bedside and into the home, and incidentally as a state representative. I had lunch today. You heard me introduce from the floor this morning my two of my very best friends who were in the audience, and I had lunch with them. There were four of us at the table, all of an age and all who had worked together. One, myself, who is a cancer survivor. As many of you know, I was diagnosed at the end of the 05 session with a particularly nasty form of lymphoma. Went into treatment, and I'm in remission. But being in remission means the disease is there hanging over your head. One of my friends at dinner has Parkinson's disease. And our conversation was about two of our other very close colleagues, both of whom are suffering from Alzheimer's. It made this bill particularly apposite for us because stem cell research has the potential to find cures for all three of these diseases. Perhaps not in time to help me or my other colleagues, but certainly to be there in time to help you all when you get to be the age where your probability of having these diseases becomes real. I mention my role as an emeritus professor because so much of what I've done as a public health scientist and a preventive medicine scientist is to try and find out how to make the scientific discoveries we have in the lab and in our clinical research settings available to the public. And I've seen the effect through my career of how, for example, the science that I've been involved in changing hypertension, the science I've been involved in preventing heart disease, the science I've been involved in improving cancer research, has all come to help actual lives. This research has the potential for doing far more than I've been able to do in terms of changing people's lives in a career doing this. And I bring it to you as a chair of the House Healthcare Committee and a representative because I think this is exactly the right time in our life cycle of legislation to address this seriously. You will hear testimony both on the economic potential, because we really believe this feeds a kind of industry that can be very vital to the future of Oregon, that can create jobs, can create tax revenues, and can create a new traded sector that can be very important to us. But also because the thing I found as a research scientist was the most important thing in terms of grant seeking was the Willie Sutton principle. We rob banks because that's where the money is. We look to NIH because that's where the money is. And we send a dollar to Washington and get back 85 cents. And one of the things I've devoted my life to is to find ways to bring more of our tax money back from Washington, D.C. to Oregon. This research has a tremendous potential to bring scientists into Oregon to foster not only the commercial development of the knowledge we create, but to foster incredible scientific research that we as a state can be very proud of. We've seen several examples of that in the past. This has probably the most potential for anything we're doing in the future. So you'll hear a lot of the technical questions. You'll hear more about this research probably from people who have opinions on varied opinions on this bill, but I'm here to urge you to take it seriously, to support it, and to move it on.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Are there questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I apologize. I didn't get here to hear the beginning of your testimony, Representative.
It was riveting.
Well, I'm sure it was. It usually is.
You can get in the archive.
But I'm wondering, I remember there was a similar bill last session. I'm wondering what the differences are. If you pointed that out already, I'll look at the archives.
No, thank you. Okay. Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher, no, that's an excellent question. One difference is it explicitly defines and prohibits human cloning. I don't need to get into why that wasn't in last time, but suffice to say it was a discussion with legislative counsel and claimed that didn't need to do that, but we thought we should do that. Also, we take out some language that was unnecessary in terms of the scope of the research, because, quite frankly, the committee that's going to be constituted to look at the ethics and the legal and ultimately scientific questions should be the people who are going to make decisions about the parameters for the research. So we took out language that we thought was no longer necessary. That is responsive.
Also curious, I remember it went through the Health Committee last time, and now it's in Economic Development. Maybe you didn't have anything to do with that, but I'm just wondering why.
Representative Reed stole it from me.
I was wondering what happened
there.
That's
why.
Well, I think there is, perhaps it happened before you came in, there is some significant economic development potential of the research community and what may happen if we're on the forefront of that. But these gentlemen and others, I think, probably speak more articulately to that, but I think there is real potential there.
Hi, I was just kidding. We did talk about where it could be, and the economic development potential is something that hasn't been explored to the extent to which it could. The health dimensions have been explored in the past.
On that, what kind of jobs are we looking at when you're saying economic development potential jobs, employment? What unemployed people now would be now in employed if this were to go through?
Well, I think it would be two things. I think it wouldn't only be the unemployed people. I think it would be our sons and daughters that go off and get PhDs at Harvard and Stanford and places like that and then have to work in terrible places in the country like Boston and Austin and San Francisco and Palo Alto. I think we could create an industry here that will draw the best and the brightest to work. Now, will there be other jobs? There'll be jobs constructing laboratories. There'll be jobs in a variety of places. But the most important jobs that we'll bring will be the key scientists around the country, the key budding scientists, to be here, because this will be the place where this research can be carried on in the most significant way.
And if I may, please, Mr. Chairman and Representative Thatcher, I think we're going to have testimony from some research scientists who probably can articulate quite well the potential economic development aspect.
Are there questions? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. thank you, gentlemen, for bringing forward a very important bill. I just want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. This bill, am I correct in saying that this bill does not require any kind of stem cell research? It simply provides grant potential should people wish to pursue that line of research, and that it creates a committee to make sure that that research and that funding is used responsibly, appropriately, and ethically?
That's correct. It not only doesn't require it, but it sets in motion the way to prevent research that's viewed as being unethical and inappropriate.
Thank you.
No other questions. Thank you, guys.
Chair.
Representative Gilliam?
Sorry, I was late. There's an indication that we're having another hearing on this?
We have
additional testimony.
That's right. It's an opportunity if there are others. We didn't have a clear understanding yet at the time of how many people might be interested in being heard, so we wanted to give ourselves some additional opportunity.
And I apologize. Was there discussion already today about conflict of researchers in this area?
Not specifically. I'm not. That's a little bit of a. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that.
I'm not either. I'll ask a quick question.
Go ahead.
Are you either one of you aware of folks in this community that is definition of cloning and stem cell research who have had a reversal or are having a major public fight about the necessity of this? I'm sorry I'm so vague, but I can't quite pull it together. Does that sound any way familiar?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, let me try. We had a lot of testimony when we heard this in the Health Committee in the last session. We had many, many scientists from the local area who were here strongly supporting the bill. We had many citizens from the area who were here opposing the bill, but not a single local scientist. We had one very fine scientist, a Jesuit priest who was a biology professor from Georgetown University, who was here arguing, I thought, very cogently and very articulately on the ethics of doing this kind of stem cell research. But I believe there was not a single scientist west of the Allegheny that testified in opposition.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, you know, in as you know, in scientific research, the beauty of science is that the idea is you don't go in with predetermined notions about what type of stem cells would be the most productive and useful. And there's an ongoing debate, and there will continue to be discussion and research about which stem cells show the most potential, and then which in terms of application are going to be the best, and that's ongoing. This bill is different from the bill last time, and you will have some researchers who will say that adult stem cells are preferable, and then you will have others that say we simply do not know, and that embryonic stem cells hold enormous potential and promise, but that with the proper ethical legal guidelines, we allow scientists to continue to do what they do, the research and development, and to figure that out. So I think it's as yet to be determined, but just as here, great minds can disagree, and you have disagreement in the scientific community, and that's part of the beauty of it.
I appreciate if you are indicating in any way that I'm part of the great minds, because
yes, I included,
I've never been called that.
Absolutely. Great voice.
Thank you. Yes. That's very kind of you as well. But I would just say I'll look forward to further discussion and to getting my act together and do a little more research. I'm sorry to come off kind of half-cocked, but I, if at all possible, want to always err on the side, from my point of view, this is strictly my point of view, on the side of adult stem cells at the, unless there is some other evidence that I'm not aware of. So I want to be very careful about this, and I know that you've already heard from folks like that, but I want to make sure I'm on record as saying this is extremely important to me, and I hope we err on that side. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. If there aren't any other questions, thank you both for being
here. Thank you, Mr. Chair,
for introducing the bill. Next on our list, Dr. Dan Dorsa from OHSU, Dr. Susan Bankowski from OHSU, and Stephen McGill. I think if I'm reading the bios up here, it would also be appropriate to call you Dr. McGill. Is that
not yet.
Not yet. Okay. Okay. A candidate. Soon to be.
I'm just a lawyer.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Dorsa, and I serve as the Vice President for Research and Senior Associate Dean for Research in the School of Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. My testimony today is to express our institution's support for House Bill 2598, which addresses stem cell research in Oregon. OHSU views stem cell research as one of the most promising areas for development of new therapies to treat a wide variety of chronic and acute diseases affecting Americans broadly, as well as a large number of Oregonians. Stem cells offer great promise because they have the ability to change their form and function and to mimic any tissue in the body and thus replace disease organs. Recognizing the enormous potential of cell-based therapies, OHSU's research community believes there's much more fundamental research to be done before this promise can be fully realized. A key question that remains is whether cells which show the greatest therapeutic potential must be derived from embryonic sources. OHSU believes that the scientific community simply does not yet know the answer to this question. The answer can only be derived by ensuring access to those cells, as well as to cells derived from other sources, including those created through nuclear transfer technology and adult sources. Indeed, last year, one of our scientists, Shukrat Matalipov, who's at the Oregon National Primate Center, which is part of OHSU, made a tremendous breakthrough in using the nuclear transfer methodology to create pluripotent stem cells, and that is cells which can differentiate into several different tissues in the non-human primate model. Now, why this was important is that it will allow scientists to test the usefulness of stem cells in this non-human primate model before they go into humans. Time magazine declared this discovery the number one science breakthrough of the year in 2007. The point is that we have a considerable amount of cutting-edge expertise here in Oregon and at OHSU that we could be capitalizing on, and that's why this legislative approach is important. We are opposed at OHSU poised to apply these discoveries to human cells of embryonic and non-embryonic origin. Therefore, since federal policy has prevented access to federal funding for research using embryonic stem cells, OHSU supports this bill, which will make it possible to conduct the necessary research to answer the important questions about the potential utility of embryonic stem cells. This is not to say that OHSU researchers have not pursued studies of alternative methods to produce cells with therapeutic potential. Indeed, in 2002, OHSU established the Oregon Stem Cell Center. Much of the work in this center is focused on understanding the genetic and molecular events that occur during embryonic development that ultimately prompt a stem cell to develop into a different cell type in the body. In doing so, it may be possible to develop new approaches which bypass the potential ethical issues raised by using cells of human embryonic origin. Basically, this research may eventually allow the creation of different types of human cells, for example, pancreatic cells, and I think you're going to hear a little bit about that in a moment, kidney cells and brain cells, without using embryonic stem cells. In fact, recent studies suggest that a small number of genes may be required to create cells that can differentiate into different cell types in the body. However, the clinical utility of any of these cells has yet to be proven. OHSU supports the creation of a fund to support stem cell research at the state level. We also support the creation of a stem cell research committee, with some caveats that I think Susan Bankowski will mention to you in her testimony. And I want to encourage a coordinated approach in the state to oversight and how we conduct embryonic stem cell research. We believe the passage of this bill and the infrastructure it creates will improve the future of all Oregonians. We also believe that it will have economic impact because the additional new research dollars, which will flow into the state to fund research at OHSU and other basic and clinical research institutions in the state, and I should say some of this research is going on at Providence Medical Center as well, will have an economic impact. We anticipate a 16-to-1 multiplier on research dollars. This is sort of a national estimate that has been made about the impact of research funding. In addition, the longer-term effects will occur in hospitals throughout the state, which will be offering new procedures, which will require new kinds of facilities and trained physicians and staff to be able to administer these therapies. And finally, long-term core costs incurred due to these chronic illnesses such as Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, liver and kidney diseases, and others will be dramatically, hopefully, reduced. In summary, OHSU strongly supports passage of HB 2598. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Dorsett. Let's hear from the rest of the panel, and perhaps we can have questions all at once.
I'll go next, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Susan Berner-Bankowski. I chair the Institutional Review Boards at OHSU. I also direct the Research Ethics Program there, and I am the Regulatory Specialist and Administrative Director for our newly commissioned Embryonic Stem Cell Research Oversight Committee that we have at OHSU. Today, I'm here also to echo what Dr. Dorsa said, that we support Hospital 2598, but I want to recognize, and within my role, I'm highly attuned to this, the complex and significant ethical concerns that accompany research involving stem cells, and we advocate attention to the national oversight models that exist and may develop under any new federal administration movements that occur in the next months and years. To explain to you, my role as the Institutional Review Board Chair currently is I'm tasked with the oversight of the ethical conduct of research involving human beings, not just the individuals themselves, but any of their individually identifiable health information. This is done in compliance with federal regulations for the protection of human subjects, and those establish parameters for the conduct of human subject research, and also an ethical review committee. And in fact, we have four boards at OHSU that are responsible for this type of oversight. So this committee performs all sorts of reviews for all the research that we do at OHSU on humans and their individually identifiable information. The OHSU Stem Cell Research Oversight Committee, we call it the OSCRO. This is a group that performs ancillary reviews currently. They provide scientific and ethical considerations for proposals that involve stem cell research. They follow the National Academies of Science guidelines for human embryonic stem cell research as well, and additional OHSU institutional requirements that we've put into place. These are not mandatory, and in fact, like many of our peer institutions, we've currently committed to self-regulation in this ethical area of research. And this is a similar model that's actually put forward in the bill, the 2598 bill. And we feel that this type of ethical oversight is a necessary element for any responsible conduct of stem cell research. And to summarize, the OSCO currently, they have a kind of a three-pronged approach. They ensure that all federal and state regulations governing the conduct of stem cell research are met, that the stem cell research is conducted in accordance with the OSCO's policies and procedures that currently exist, and that human embryonic stem cell research is conducted in accordance with the National Academies of Science guidelines. It reviews at a minimum the scientific design of the research and the justification, the procedures for deriving and banking stem cell lines, informed consent of cell donors, and this is done in tandem with the Institutional Review Board, the qualifications of the researcher, regulatory compliance, and procurement of the procurement process for stem cell lines, which is important right now given the federal limits on funding that's specific to that. It has a chair and members with expertise in assisted reproduction, developmental biology, legal and ethical issues of stem cell research, embryology, molecular biology, and stem cell research methods and science. Additionally, this group is poised to monitor what's going on at a national and state level with respect to changes in science and oversight, and they have established and will continue to evolve the policies of OHSU that currently exist as the science changes and the politics change. As Dr. Dorsey said, we're committed, OHSU, to facilitating the growth of this scientific endeavor and industry in Oregon and nationally, and doing so in a way that has robust scientific and ethical oversight. At some point in the future, we do anticipate and hope that the national ban on embryonic stem cell funding will be lifted. If this occurs, undoubtedly, NIH dollars will be conditioned, as many NIH dollars are now, and to receive dollars, you will likely have to follow some sort of requirements set by the NIH, perhaps the National Academies of Science guidelines. While it's important that we implement local level requirements here, we want to make sure that we don't unintentionally limit our ability to conduct stem cell research also here in Oregon. We have a lot of experience with the Oregon Genetic Privacy Act. My office specifically deals with this a lot in having it work effectively in research. And this has created many unintended compliance requirements that are more restrictive than federal rules. And so we want to make sure that we aren't making Oregon unattractive to researchers as well. We're committed to advancing stem cell research in Oregon and adhering to these standards. We support the passage and hope we can remain responsive to the national agenda that's changing. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing me today.
Thank you very much. Mr. McGill.
Hi. For the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Stephen McGill. I'm an MD PhD student up at OHSU, and I wanted to come here and tell you just a little bit in just a couple minutes sort of what I do and sort of what stem cell research looks like. So in my career track, I'm getting trained both as a physician and a scientist with the ultimate goal that I would be able to understand and participate in scientific discovery and then translating that towards sort of clinical application. So an area like stem cells is a very fascinating area given the excitement and promise of it. And I'm in my fifth year of training right now, and I'm doing full-time research. And what I do is I work on mouse embryonic stem cells, and the goal is to enhance the process of turning them into cells that can sense glucose levels and make insulin. So diabetes, one of the fundamental defects in diabetes is a destruction of the beta cells, which are cells in your pancreas that make insulin. And so, as we all are aware of, people take insulin then to supplement those levels. But one of the major, some of the major consequences that come from that is that by giving yourself insulin injections, you have nowhere near the precise control of your levels of insulin and regulation of blood glucose that occurs in someone with a functioning pancreas. And so the idea behind a cell-based therapeutic would be that these cells could be exquisitely sensitive, just like the cells in the pancreas, and you could give them back to people, which has been done with cadaveric pancreatic islet transplants, but could also, you could have cells that could sense glucose levels and respond to insulin. Our lab is part of the Beta Cell Biology Consortium, which is a group of about 40 labs that are sponsored by the NIH, and the goal of the BCBC is to develop cell-based therapies for diabetes. In my work, I work with mouse stem cells because of the federal ban on human stem cells and some of the ethical considerations there. But the lab where I learned the technique where you turn them into the stem cells into pancreatic insulin-producing cells, they're working with human cells now down in California. So we're sort of behind the times in that regard, but we can still learn some fundamental processes. And it's an interesting model because not only I can work at manipulating genetic elements to try to produce more insulin-producing cells, or it also allows us to study sort of the normal development. It gives us sort of a cell culture models to study development of the pancreas. So stem cell research isn't just promoting stem cell research allows us to develop new therapies, hopefully some cell-based therapies, but it also, by studying this and promoting the research, we're gaining insights into how normal development can occur and using this as a model to study development. And it takes a lot of time to make progress, so I think anything we can do to support and facilitate research, and in particular facilitate research being done in a very ethical manner and something that's acceptable and is very good. So I just wanted to tell you that, and if there's any questions and anything else, I'd be happy to listen.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. It helps always to have direct experience and understanding of how, what it means in reality. So, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's for Susan Berner-Bankowski.
Dr. Berner, thank you.
Doctor. In your testimony towards the very end, you mentioned that you had a lot of experience with the Oregon genetic privacy law and its unintended compliance requirements that are more restrictive than federal rules. I don't imagine that this bill addresses those requirements at all. Are you aware of any pending legislation that does address that?
No, it was... thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Holby. It was to... draw a parallel, actually, that in that process, in establishing that oversight, there are many compliance requirements that I believe may have been unintended even by the legislators, that in administratively carrying out the requirements have become cumbersome and not necessarily achieving those goals. So it was more of the goals of the legislation. So it was more of an analogy to an existing law that we work with.
Follow up? Well, I guess along those lines, I'm just curious whether you've had any discussions with any legislators or people that are interested in addressing those more restrictive rules that could alleviate the unintended compliance requirements specifically, because as you go on to say, it makes it unattractive for some researchers to come to Oregon. So I think that that's something we should be, you know, perhaps having a conversation about, if nothing else.
And we certainly are. We have Dr. Kara Drolet is our representative, I believe, that works on those issues for OHSU and is in an active dialogue on those issues continually since the inception of the law.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I think it would be wise for this committee to maybe take a look at that specifically if it is an impediment to new researchers coming to Oregon. Thank you.
Appreciate you highlighting that question. It is one worth further discussion. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the panel's testimony, you mentioned a couple of times that there was a federal ban on embryonic stem cell research, and I'm wondering what the basis of that ban is, and was that an act of Congress?
Thank you. I believe it was an act of the past president, and it was
an executive
order, and it went through. It limited using federal dollars, NIH dollars specifically, for any embryonic stem cell research, unless it was on using existing stem cell lines, and there was a designated list of stem cell lines that were allowed to have use federal dollars for research.
Thank you very much.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a sentence in your report which I'm not following. It says it's important that while we implement local level requirements that we don't unintentionally limit our ability to conduct stem cell research in Oregon. What were you getting at there with that sentence?
Thank you. There are National Academy of Science guidelines that exist. They're pretty comprehensive, and they have frequent amendments. So we just had an amendment come out about 6 weeks ago. There was another one in 2007. I am unaware of any peer institution of our size, and we do so as well, that does not follow these guidelines for stem cell research. So they are optional at this point. And they have an active group of scientists who inform those, ethicists, regulators who inform those, and just that I think they are very responsive to the changes in the science, and they're currently the leading place and the best practice as to how to have oversight for stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research.
Paula.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is your concern that the creation of the committee suggested by this legislation would be restrictive, and that's why you mentioned this?
Yes.
I see. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious for our researcher in the middle here. Could you just describe a little bit more the limitations of research on mouse stem cells?
I'm not sure exactly what you're... There aren't limitations right now on using the mouse stem cells, but which is why we've used them. But to do the same experiments using human embryonic stem cells, we'd have to go through a very different process, and there's a lot of problems with the current lines that are available, because each stem cell line, it keeps dividing, and so people use the progeny of that as a line. But after they divide a lot more times, after you get hundreds of divisions or thousands of divisions, which they divide about every day, so in a couple of years, they're not as good. They lose some of the characteristics that would make them just like freshly isolated stem cells. So with the mouse, we can use, there's better lines, and there's also, and there's new lines that can be made without any problem, and that's done commonly. But to do that in human cells, and with the goal being a cell-based therapy for diabetes, we obviously, you don't want mouse cells injected into you. That's not going to work out very well. So we want to do this with, if you wanted to do this type of research with human cells, it would be very difficult. And to get good cell lines, ones that haven't been passaged for 7, 8, 9 years, I think that's sort of what I was alluding to.
Sort of the copy of a copy sort of thing? As a non-scientist, is that a way of summarizing it, perhaps?
Yeah, I guess you could use that as an example. The more times you copy a copy, it changes. And the nature of the cells, their behavior can change somewhat as they're passaged each time. A passage is basically a copy when they divide.
Thank you. Did you want to follow up?
Thank you. That's very helpful information. And I guess the other part of my question, which I wasn't very clear about, is how far can your research progress using mice stem cells?
Well, we can take diabetic mice. We can develop these cells that produce insulin and inject them into the diabetic mice and see how it affects their diabetes, you know. So we're using people use diabetic mouse models. My research isn't at that stage right now, but people using these types of cells have done that many times. And so you can progress all the way to testing the therapy.
But only in mice?
And only in mice, yeah. You would need to use human cells or primate cells to test in a primate model, if you will.
Representative Wood?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a non-scientist here, if you could help me, when you introduce these cells into the human body, are there rejection problems that are associated with that?
Yeah, can I take a...
Please.
Dr. Dorsey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, that's a great question, and it's very important because we right now are addressing that very issue with the research that I mentioned in Shukrat Metalipov's lab at the Primate Center. The issue, as you are hearing, is if you use human embryos to derive embryonic stem cells, if they come from another individual or kind of a pair of individuals, say from a fertility clinic or whatever, we don't know whether there might not be rejection problems as you have when you do a organ transplant in a human being. The work that Dr. Metalipov is doing is to create a genetically identical source of those stem cells, and he's done that in monkeys. And what he's doing right now is testing that in monkeys to see whether, in fact, it's true that you get around these rejection problems. And once tested, then the next step would be to get into the human. And if I might just take another second, his problem right now is that because of the prohibition against human embryonic stem cell research, we cannot take it to the next step in any existing laboratory at OHSU because of our widespread federal funding of research at our facility. So right today, to move that work research forward, which we think is very important, we need to quarantine off, if you will, a laboratory specially for this purpose, make sure there are absolutely no federal dollars in any way, shape, or form touching the salary, the equipment, the whatever we need to do that kind of research. And it is incredibly cumbersome and in the way of now moving to test that hypothesis that he's you know, granted being able to test in a preclinical model in the monkey, that's terrific and it's got a lot of notoriety, but we here feel in Oregon we can make the next step, and that's what's in our way.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to try this again, and I apologize. You want to talk about non-scientists, but I'll try again. First of all, I just want to say that I have seen personally, very personally, the good work that's done on the Hill, and I know of your commitment to alleviating suffering. So you've got no problem with me. But I think we're in a very thorny area and a very serious area. And when we talk about change in administration and political changes, those are, from some people's point of view, those are rooted in ethical changes. So it gets a little bit thorny. I want to first clarify something that my colleague asked and that you just referred to. Are we under a ban of federal funding, or are we banned from the research itself? It sounds to me like we're banned from federal funding. I think it's an important distinction. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So to my earlier remark, I just wanted to ask you, to Susan Benkowski, I understand I was reading the second page of your testimony, but we may be unattractive to some researchers, and from an economic development standpoint, which is part of this committee's chart, that's an important point. But would you agree that above that point, for the purposes of what you're trying to do, it's not just creating jobs and new business. More importantly, and you said this, but I just want to make sure I get you right, the goal for the university, for the Science Center, is the ethical treatment of patients and the alleviation of suffering. That's more important than being attractive to 100% of the researchers in this country.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam. Yes, and especially my role is to advocate for individuals who volunteer to be research subjects. So the goals of the committees that have the oversight for the ethical conduct of research are a bit different even than those of a clinical care provider who is working on individuals' best interest. Ethical oversight committees for research work on risk-benefit analysis. They look at the science. They look at the benefits of the science. They have models and requirements to weigh those and decide if the science can progress at all, given lots of concerns with respect to individual autonomy, cultural issues, a variety of ethical issues. And the Institutional Review Board does that, and then for stem cell research at OHSU, the embryonic stem cell research provides that ancillary review currently. So definitely, yes, and my job is ethical oversight first and foremost.
Thank you. That's helpful. If you'll indulge me, one more question, Mr.
Go ahead,
Chair.
Please.
Does the panel have copies of the bill in front of them?
I do not. I read it.
Let me try this, and if I'm putting you on the spot without having it in front of you, I apologize, and you can pass. On page 2, it makes it real clear in the beginning, upper part of that page, that this is not about cloning, that we're not doing cloning. Cloning is not what the goal is here. So my question is, down here, section 1, line 19, subpoint 4, it says, somatic cell nuclear transfer means a technique in which the nucleus of a
OOCYTE
is replaced by the nucleus of a donated human somatic cell, et cetera, et cetera. Is there credible, and that's subjective, I know, but is there a credible disagreement in the scientific community that you know of over the that definition being, could be, some think it is cloning? Is that something that you could comment on?
I can comment, yes, I can. The distinction that I see in the work I do is between therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning. And this would be considered therapeutic, and reproductive would be to create a copy and make another being. So that's the distinction that I know. I work more in compliance and oversight, though, so I don't know if others have comments.
I think it's well put.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify for Representative Gilliam that if you look at, you should have the amendment, the proposed amendments to the bill at the back, and lines 19 through 21, which you just referred, are not part of the bill.
They're deleted by the amendment.
Deleted, right? Yeah, they would be deleted by the amendment. Should we?
So line 3 of the amendment says delete lines 19 through 21 on page 2.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It gets in the... there you go.
Well, those amendments.
Dr. Dorsey, you had a
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam. I agree with you. This is an area that we need to be very careful about the language.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really get much of a chance to see the amendment before it was placed here, so we would very much want to work with the committee on ensuring that that language is proper and correct. At its essence, it's really what the intent is. If the intent is to implant that into a uterus of a woman and allow it to go to term, that is human cloning.
Mm-hmm.
And there are nuances in between, but that's what will not happen under this bill or at OHSU.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the future, I would think the Vice Chair would come to my office and read those amendments to me, but that's fine.
Representative Galizia.
Thank you. And I'm glad Representative Gilliam asked the question so we could get on the record the distinction between reproductive and therapeutic cloning. So two things really quickly. First, I wanted to thank, I want to call you Dr. McGill, but since Mr.
Presumptive?
Yeah, presumptive Dr. McGill. Yeah. He testified before our Ways and Means Education Subcommittee for OHSU, and I was very, very impressed, as all of us were on the committee. We recognize that he is an overachiever. We're a little worried, MD and PhD. We're slackers, but you already knew that.
And we'd like to keep him here in Oregon.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this is actually, thank you for that segue to my, I had a question for Mr. McGill, a presumptive Dr. McGill, and then for Dr. Dorsa or Ms. Bankowski, for presumptive Dr. McGill, this is fun. Do you think that researchers and students and brilliant minds that we want here doing research in Oregon might look to other states such as California, New Jersey, Connecticut, and others that have already authorized funding for comprehensive stem cell research, it might look at that and see, well, OHSU is not really, we're not doing that here, and see that as an impediment. And then my question for Ms. Bankowski is, in terms of funding, NIH funding, or for Dr. Dorsa, either of you, for NIH funding, is it accurate to conclude that states that have authorized funding, California, New Jersey, others, and Oregon, if we were to adopt this bill, would be at a competitive advantage when researchers are seeking NIH money?
I think very clearly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Glizio, I think very clearly states like California that have already made the investment and made it possible to conduct this research are certainly well ahead in terms of their overall scientific base. And so I think, quite frankly, in the field right now, people are doing stem cell research. When they see advertisements coming out of California universities and so forth, say, yeah, that's part of, I want to be part of that. Having said that, however, as I pointed out, we have some excellent people here who have published in the best places in the world their findings. And those people do want to come to Oregon, but they don't want to be inhibited by the current state of the prohibitions against conducting all forms of research that are necessary under ethical conditions to answer the questions.
Yeah, I would say absolutely in response to your question about whether or not that would impact your decision. If you wanted to study, if you wanted to work with human stem cells and do that, I mean, it'd be, you would want to go to a place where that's condoned and where the oversight is set up so you can do that in a manner that's ethical and responsible.
Thank you.
Mr. Dorsa, I remember you saying something about Providence. Both of you, I think, on the ends, mentioned something about Providence doing research now. Is that on human stem cells?
My understanding is that some of that research is being conducted. I'm not sure it's actually being conducted physically at Providence, but it is being conducted in collaboration with people in Boston. And it is involving cardiac, potential cells that could be used for cardiac replacement and myocardial infarction and so forth.
I guess maybe a clarification, embryonic specifically, or adult stem cells as well as embryonic? Or
you know, I can't say I for sure know the answer to that question, but I know there is stem cell research going on. Some of it may be embryonic, but I'm not sure. I can't.
But it is human stem cell research.
Definitely.
Okay, and so there is currently research going on. What we're wanting to do is see that we can get federal taxpayer, federal money into the state to provide grants or subsidize this.
The bill, and be happy to be heard by the sponsor, is attempting to set up the structure to manage that so that we're making sure we're doing things correctly with the proper oversight and give ourselves the chance to do it if someone wants to engage in that. Is that about right, Representative Clinton?
Well, I'd say, Representative Thatcher, set up a fund so that you could accept private money, because you know there are people who feel very strongly about this issue, as well as if we were so to choose to make a state investment in support of the research. So that's what it would do. It would allow for the to accept private or state money.
Whereas right now only private money would be allowed to research, and so we would be in competition with those other entities that are doing it privately. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, there is industry is sponsoring this kind of research as well, and currently there's no prohibition against using industry-sponsored research, conducting industry-sponsored research, so that also goes on.
Please.
Chairman, Representative Thatcher, to echo what Dr. Dorsa said, one of the difficulties is it's twofold. It's the intermingling, the way that our institution is established, that the NIH dollars are everywhere. And so part of the Stem Cell Research Oversight Committee review process that we have in place currently is the procurement process, and that involves a very detailed look at who's conducting the research, what equipment they're using, and we understand that in states where funds exist, this is less of an issue because there's a better way to pool dollars alongside the fact that there is federal money as well. But it's facilitated in when there's a larger fund that is central. It helps research be conducted in an easier way.
Unrelated question, but
okay,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned how you're working on mouse stem cells, mm-hmm. and I don't know, I understood you've been there for about 5 years, but I don't know if you've been doing that the entire 5 years. I'm just wondering if you're aware of any promising developments where you've actually cured a mouse disease, you know, with mouse stem cells, or you know, a chimpanzee with chimpanzee stem cells, or anything like that. Just wondering if there's been any... along the embryonic stage.
In my field, I've been doing this for about 2 years now, where I've been focused full-time on pancreatic beta cell development and biology. By doing transplants and taking cells that have been generated from embryonic cells, they've transplanted them into mice that have been given a drug that kills the beta cells. So they have a drug-induced diabetes, basically, to make a model of that. And if you transplant these cells in, you can cause their blood sugars to come back to normal. So I guess, in a sense, we have cured it to some degree in the mouse. The problem with that, and the problem with this is that a lot of times the cells, they'll cure it at 2 weeks, at 3 weeks, you'll bring the blood sugars back to normal. But then over time, because the cells aren't fully differentiated, they're not completely like beta cells, they'll start proliferating like stem cells, and they'll form tumors or things like that in the mouse. So I think it gets to the definition of curing. But the idea is that, yes, we have cured diabetes. You've normalized their blood sugars in these mice that have diabetes. But the problem is we don't know how to make these cells in a state where they won't form tumors, where they won't have other complications, and where they'll last for a long time. And I think that's really where the research is pushing there, and how to enhance the process. If we take a stem cell and you go through a differentiation, you might get 5% of your cells at the end of your experiment that would be making insulin. So to do that, you have to have ways to pick them out so you only implant the cells that are making insulin, so you're not implanting other cells. So if we can enhance this process and make it more efficient, then that's, I think, where a lot of the research progress will be. And if you do it with human cells, you could do it at a volume then that would be necessary to be used in a human.
I thank you for that answer, and I thank you for using plain English. You did very well. Thank you.
That was very well. Well done. Representative Benz.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going back to the person on the panel who is just a lawyer. As just a lawyer also, this is a question I'm interested in. I'm going back to the line in your letter where you state that the funds will undoubtedly be conditioned on following the National Institute of Health requirements for the conduct of such research, and it's important that while we implement local-level requirements, we don't unintentionally... Because we are in the process of creating a committee, one of the purposes of which is to address these ethical issues, it almost just seems to get the money, we'd have to abandon that ethical element. So I guess my question is, how do we make sure that we're not inadvertently, by creating this committee and then instructing it to go for the money, we're not abandoning one of the most important parts of its purpose, particularly if we're going to have to, in order to get the money, do whatever NIH says?
Thank you, Chairman, Representative Bench. I think that the hope is that we would make sure we're synchronized with the national standards that are being developed and exist. We follow those currently, and they're difficult to follow because they change frequently, but that's the way the science is. And so the hope is that whatever model we use, it is responsive to the national guidelines as they develop, as they're very thoughtful and incredibly they're detailed. You know, they have prohibitions written into them, for instance, that that disallow conducting any research that goes beyond like a 14-day blastocyst or the formation of a primitive streak, which are very early days in embryonic development. And so they are at a level that is well informed by scientists. And so I would just hope that we are synchronized with those guidelines.
Follow up, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the choice to the committee is going to be if it determines that from an ethical standpoint it wants to do something and it doesn't square with the NIH, then it would be a decision that committee would make, and of course the result would be no funding.
It as long as they are more restrictive than permissive, it wouldn't limit funding. My concern is that more restrictive may have inadvertent effects on the way that we either have oversight or compliance or conduct our research, that this group is very adept at thinking about what is an appropriate level of oversight for the conduct of embryonic stem cell research. And so it wouldn't be a prohibition if it was less restrictive. Or more restrictive, sorry. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious about medical history, because I would have to assume that as the medical frontier advances through each one of our medical advances, that at each gateway, at each frontier, our concern about ethics and the potential danger to humans advances as well. And I would imagine that perhaps at some point that physician who administered the first vaccination was probably very concerned, and there may have in fact been a good deal of discussion about the potential for our eliminating the human race or whatever, or creating a new disease or whatever. But I guess the point I'm trying to get to is, do we not allay to some extent those kinds of concerns as we're able to advance our research as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I absolutely agree with you, and I think it's very important to understand that at OHSU, the IRB and its functions and the ethics portion of the institution really are charged to protect human subjects and to address the ethical issues in the conduct of research, and they do that in a very independent fashion. And it is a challenge, and as Susan pointed out to you, she's just convened a committee now internally within the institution to address stem cell research. And I can tell you it's caused a lot of discussion and controversy within our own institution, and a lot of emails back and forth about people who feel very passionately about the ethical issues involved and their ability to conduct the research they want to conduct. But Susan and their group is charged to work with them, hear them, but at the end of the day formulate an institutional approach to this that the institution is comfortable with. And we, of course, would want to work closely with the committee that gets established by the state to ensure that we're in step with that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are other questions. I appreciate you being here and hope you can stick around. We have a number of other people who have indicated their interest in testifying. I suspect we may have more detailed questions for you as we come along, so if you could stick around, we would be most appreciative. With that, I'll call up Dr. Katrina Hedberg. Jake, and I heard your name pronounced, but I'm a little worried that I'm going to mispronounce it now. Is it Guth and Gail Atterbury? Jake, did I pronounce your name correctly?
You got it.
Excellent. Thank you. And if you could decide amongst yourselves who would like to go first, I'd be happy to hear from you.
Representative, I just have one question. We have one testifier from the state of Washington that I would like to ensure gets to talk, and I would defer my time till Thursday if that would help your schedule.
Okay. Well, why don't we
Why don't we go ahead, and I suspect that unless there's a ton of questions generated from yours, we will have time to hear from you as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jay Guth, and I'm a senior at Central Catholic High School in Portland. And I guess to summarize my testimony, I am in support of House Bill 2598. However, I have some concerns as a younger citizen and some questions for you as well. A few weeks ago, I was presented with the opportunity to come here today and testify, and to be quite honest, I was not sure where I stood on this issue. Politically, I fall on the left, and I'm a product of two like-minded parents with their bachelor's in science degrees from Berkeley. As I began researching this issue, I discovered a common trend. The progress in stem cell research has moved very quickly. From what I understand, there are two types of stem cells used today. The first being embryonic stem cells, and the second is the induced pluripotent stem cell, which can be derived from a skin cell. And from what I read, the use of induced pluripotent stem cells carries a lot of great potential. By taking such a cell as like a skin cell, wiping it clean, and inserting the gene combination that is needed to create the desired effect, scientists and doctors would be able to create stem cells and potentially cures which are patient-specific. And there would be less, ethical hoops to jump through. Now, I also learned, however, that since this discovery is so new, it is not quite an exact science, and that more research needs to be done. But if and when the discoveries are made and the embryonic stem cell becomes obsolete, it would be my hope that there would be no need to continue using them and there would be no ethical debate. In reading the House bill, and they don't teach you to read these things in high school, there were a few things
we need to change
eye.
That, too.
In Section 14 of House Bill 2598, the state will appropriate $159,366 beginning July 1st of this year for the purpose of providing administrative support, which is from page 4, lines, I believe, 35 and 36. My question about the appropriation of these funds is why, I guess, in the midst of Oregon's financial instability, this new program is being created. And just last week in the Ways and Means Committee, an agreement was reached to fill the $855 million hole in the Oregon budget by cutting funding. In the next 4 months, the state plans to cut $311 million from the budget, of which $116 million of that cut is from the public school system, which would cause, I guess, many schools to close early and ask teachers to volunteer their time rather than work for pay. These cuts will also call for our state courts to cut back to only 4 days a week. My question then is why then in the midst of all these cuts, especially the $116 million to be taken from public education, will the state be allocating $159,366 for administrative support? And thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. And
thank you for coming. I appreciate it. You put your finger on one of the real issues that I think is relevant to lots of bills. The budget is looming over a lot of things. We're really glad that you're able to be with us and hope you inspire some of your classmates to take an active role in what we do here, too. Please go ahead, and we'll take some questions for you after you finish. Thanks.
Okay, that's me. Okay. Chair Reed and member of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the interim state epidemiologist with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify on 2598. The bill addresses a very important issue, the conduct of human stem cell research. And as you've heard, the stem cell research has a potential to lead to advances in both medical care for many diseases, as well as to economic benefits for Oregon. And I think as with any new technology, it's really important to be able to balance both these potential benefits, but also to help to weigh some of the complex and serious both ethical and political issues surrounding stem cell. And we believe that that the committee that's proposed in this legislation would do a would help to balance some of these issues. So I think you're all aware that it establishes a committee within the Department of Human Services both to look at guidelines and to solicit funds for grants to conduct this kind of research, as well as to set guidelines for what's appropriate with informed consent, and then also, as has been mentioned, banning cloning. So while DHS supports the goals of House Bill 2598 in laying the groundwork for conducting stem cell research in Oregon, there is a fiscal impact with this bill, as was just noted, and it is not included in the governor's budget. So I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Ms. Atterbury?
Committee Reed. My name is Gail Atterbury, and I'm from the Director of Oregon Right to Life, and I'm opposed to House Bill 2598. You're going to get a big packet from me, but believe me, I'm not going to give you all of that testimony. There's a lot of documentation that's coming with that packet. Human life begins at the moment of fertilization. This is not a new or a little-known fact. Medical textbooks teach that the most basic fact of embryology, and that is that each life begins at fertilization. I have some quotes from medical textbooks in my testimony right before you. The one I will read to you from the Pathology of the Fetus and the Infant from 1976 states, every time a sperm cell and an ovum unite, a new being is created which is alive and will continue to live unless its death is brought about by some specific condition. House Bill 2598 includes the encouragement of and funding for embryonic stem cell research, which of course we're not unaware of by this time in the testimony. The bill refers to a blastocyst. A blastocyst is an embryo who is 5 days old, 5 days after fertilization. It is at the blastocyst stage that the developing embryo has around 100 to 150 stem cells inside its outer shell. These cells are undifferentiated and are valuable to researchers because they want to coax them into specific types of cells in trying to find cures for people, which we've discussed. The only problem is that in order to get the stem cells, the 5-day-old human embryo is killed. We were all, every single one of us sitting here, were once a 5-day-old blastocyst, just as we were all once a 5-day-old infant out of our mother's womb. To destroy a blastocyst is to destroy a human being, and for that reason, Oregon Right to Life opposes 2598. There's been a, as we are aware, an amendment that's been proposed that has changed a teeny bit of my testimony, but not much, so I'm going to continue. And under Section 2, confusion. This bill appears to do more than it actually does and could lull many Oregonians into thinking that this bill is a ban on human cloning. Section 8, oh, by the way, except until we got this new amendment, which we just saw, the only difference between 2007's bill of 2801A and this bill was the addition of Section 8, which states a person commits the crime of human cloning. So basically, the only difference between 2007 and 2009's bill is the ban on human cloning. Although it did speak until the amendment of somatic cell nuclear transfer. What is clear to, not clear to many, is that human cloning and somatic cell nuclear transfer are the exact same thing. And I went to the computer and got some very interesting definitions for you. And this first set of definitions is from the International Society for Stem Cell Research, ISSCR. This committee is the world's leading professional organization of stem cell researchers. And if you looked at its members and its leadership, you would find the leading PhDs from all around the world. And some of the definitions from the ICCS include cloning, the process in which an organism produces one or more genetic alike copies of itself by somatic cell nuclear transfer. Reproductive cloning is somatic cell nuclear transfer used for the fetus, production of a fetus, which basically is the delivery of a human being. However, therapeutic cloning, which this committee is talking about, is somatic cell nuclear transfer for in for the isolation, particularly just of the embryonic stem cells, and then these stem cells are retrieved from the blastocyst, which has been killed. Also, down below, I went for more definitions from the European Commission 2003 report on human embryonic stem cell research. This particular paper that I took these definitions for is a foundational document used by the entire European Union to establish its regulations on human embryonic stem cell research. And one of their definitions is very, very telling. In the next page, cloning by somatic cell nuclear transfer involves placing an egg's nucleus with the nucleus, replacing the egg's nucleus with the nucleus of the adult cell to be cloned, and then the egg genetically reprograms the transferred nucleus, enabling it to direct development of the whole new organism. Basically, they're talking there about reproductive cloning. Or the development is stopped at the blastocyst stage, and the embryonic stem cells are derived from the inner cell mass, and that is called therapeutic cloning. I'd like to have you just, if you wouldn't mind, turn two pages back to Exhibit A, because I think one picture is worth a thousand words, and you'll understand better what I'm saying by looking at the picture. We're talking about cloning in that diagram. Basically, pretty simple, just follow the arrows. We start with a skin cell donor who donates the nucleus from that cell. And that nucleus of that cell is inserted into an egg from a woman whose nucleus, that nucleus from that woman's egg has been removed, and the nucleus from the donor has been put in. They're fused together. You end up with a human embryo. It's grown for 5 days to the blastocyst stage, and that is cloning. And then at that point, there's a decision to be made. Will you insert that blastocyst into a human mother where you have reproductive cloning, or will you take that blastocyst to the researcher's petri dish and dissect it to get the embryonic, the stem cells from it? So basically, the only difference between reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning is what you do with a five-day-old blastocyst.
Ms. Atterbury, may I ask you, just as we are looking at the...
Yes, I'm just about done. That was the point I really wanted to...
I was trying to wait for you a place that might be a good spot to bring you.
That's a real point I wanted to make.
And the mic thing.
Yes. Yeah. Once again, we're trying to move a little bit of
right,
so
okay,
not swallowing
right,
the mic.
You,
it distorts
you.
A little bit on the sound system.
Thank you very much. So even though it's not made clear in this bill, even the amendment... even the amendment doesn't make it clear, it can be resumed that all that's being cloned, or all that's being banned, is reproductive cloning, and that therapeutic cloning would not be banned. And even in therapeutic cloning, you destroy a human blastocyst, a human embryo. So at the very least, I strongly urge an amendment which would clarify the fact that we are banning reproductive cloning only. And therapeutic cloning will still be permitted through this bill, even in spite of the amendment. I would just, obviously, Oregon Right to Life is opposed to human cloning, so I will skip that section. And the reason we are is because you end up, in this bill, killing the human blastocyst. Just as in a little summary, in section 4, I titled this Crummy Consequences versus Congratulations. As has been spoken of previously, we have found throughout the last 10 years of embryonic stem cell research that we have had enormous amount of problems, and we have had no, to my knowledge, known success story through embryonic stem cell research. And I have section D, I have a exhibit, which just came across my desk just this last week, about supposedly a cure to a young boy in Russia through stem cell research, embryonic, and he now has been operated to remove the tumors. That seems to be the number one problem with embryonic stem cell research. Conversely, the successes of adult stem cell human trials are abundant and continue to increase. And I have included in the exhibit just very recent good things coming from adult stem cell research and the newest form of exciting breakthrough, which is called direct reprogramming, where they are able to use regular skin cells and reprogram them to be embryonic stem cells. In conclusion, Oregon Right to Life applauds this committee in its desire to help find cures for those with debilitating diseases and injuries. However, Oregon Right to Life encourages this committee to use this noble desire by amending this bill to exclude all human cloning, including reproductive cloning and embryonic stem cell research, and instead go where business is really booming, where life-saving research is bringing results: adult stem cell research and reprogramming.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Galizio.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to Jake's question, because I'm not sure if you got that response. The $159,000, which we're trying to actually lower, but it's the administrative cost to set up the stem cell research committee that would then come up with the guidelines, the ethical guidelines for the research. So to administratively create and maintain that, plus also the grant fund. So that's what the costs are for. In other words, it's not money that is directly going into research at this point. It's just to support the people who are going to get together to come up with the guidelines, and that's what that money's for.
Okay.
Representative Calizio, in the amendment that I was handed, it says on line 5 that members of the committee are not entitled to compensation or reimbursement for expenses and service volunteers on the committee. Do you mean that the members of the committee would not be paid for their time? You're saying that it's merely for administrative assistance, I guess, in the Health and Human Services?
Right.
Okay.
The people would be paid as much as you got paid to come here.
Okay. Which is,
zero.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. No hesitation. That was good. For the record, those of you on the internet, there was no hesitation.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Are there questions? Thank you very much. Dr. Teresa Deischer, and then we have a couple of other folks, too, which I think I'll call up as a panel afterwards. So just as you get settled, we're taking note of the clock here, too, so if we can try to summarize quickly, we'll try to get everyone who has signed up in today, and we appreciate you being here.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Teresa Deischer. I'm here from Seattle, Washington, and definitely west of the Alleghenies. I am a commercial stem cell scientist. I've been working in the field since 1990. I'm also a potential beneficiary of any embryonic stem cell research that might occur if it could be proven to be safe, because I have early stages of Parkinson's disease, and you'll notice I have a chronic and hereditary tremor. However, I am not in favor of embryonic stem cell research, and it's difficult for me to be morally passionate about this issue. I'm a scientist. I like to look at the facts. And what I find is that it's just not a smart commercial issue, and it's not a smart use of taxpayer dollars. So I have a handout. I'd want to jump ahead. It says three questions to ask, and I'd like to start there, because with the recent discovery of spermatogonial stem cells and the adult reprogram stem cells, we can take these polarizing moral issues out of the debate, and we can actually look at the science and look at what is good for society, what is good for our patients. So three questions I'd like you to think about is, why do we want embryos? Why are embryos included in this bill? What is best for the patient, and what is best for society? So if you flip ahead to the next page, there's a definition of pluripotent stem cells, which include embryonic stem cells. They're derived from the killing of embryos. There are induced pluripotent stem cells that are derived from adult skin cells, and testicular or spermatogonial stem cells. Now, that was recently reproduced by Stanford University. The work was first done in Germany and published in 2006. Those spermatogonial stem cells are included in your House bill. Those cells have equivalent qualities, and they are embryonic-like qualities. Those qualities make the cells not appropriate for human therapy. And I will talk in just a minute about the tumor formation that's associated with the cells, but I want to show you that those adult reprogrammed cells can actually be used for human cloning. This is a paper published in Science. It's done in mice. They took a reprogrammed cell, they injected it into an incompetent embryo, okay, that could only give rise to a placenta, and the result was that the baby mouse that was born was a complete copy of that reprogrammed cell. So you can do cloning with these cells. And the language in your bill actually does not ban even reproductive cloning. And I don't have that in this talk. I hadn't seen the full language. But if you have some questions, we can feel free to ask me. So if you go to the next page, another question, why do we want embryos? The only difference between the induced pluripotent stem cells and the spermatogonial stem cells is that they require an embryo in order to be cloned, to be reproductively cloned. Their qualities in the test tube are identical. So it's curious to me why people continue to insist that we want embryos and that we need new embryos. I want to comment a little bit about presumptive Dr. McGill's testimony and some of the statements that I heard earlier. So people describe these pluripotent stem cells as the best potential cure for many diseases. And that is a gross distortion of the truth. We've had embryonic stem cells since 1980 when mouse embryonic stem cells were first isolated. We've been working with these cells for 28 years now. There is no therapy that has come from those embryonic mouse stem cells. In contrast, most, if not all, of our blockbuster human biologics have been discovered from adult animal cells. Many of the diseases that people talk about potentially being cured by stem cell therapies are not candidates for stem cell therapy at all, diabetes being one of those. Diabetes is an autoimmune disease. What that means is that your body attacks your own islet cells. It kills off the islet-producing cells, and you develop the disease of diabetes. If we treat a patient with diabetes with replacement cells to produce insulin, those cells are also attacked and killed. That's why cadaveric cells, insulin-producing cells, do not last very long in these patients. They're attacked by the autoimmune attack as well. Embryonic stem cells would also be attacked. Type 1 diabetes, unfortunately no one mentioned, has actually recently been cured with a form of adult stem cell treatment. Now, it's not the adult stem cells that are curing the disease. What they did was they did a form of mini chemotherapy, and they killed off the cells attacking the pancreas. In doing that, you cause some peripheral damage to the patient. So before they gave them any chemotherapy, they withdrew bone marrow from the patient, the patient's own bone marrow, gave them the mini chemotherapy, and then they rescued their blood system with the patient's own stem cells. The result were that 16 of 17 patients became insulin independent. That's unheard of. Now, this work was done in Brazil, because there's no funding for these types of adult stem cell clinical trials in the U.S. We became so polarized over these moral issues, we forgot to think about our patients. Phase 2 studies are now being followed up in the United States. What happened in those studies, physicians from Tufts University flew to Brazil to do those trials. So that's just one example where we need to step back. We need to look at the actual pathology of the disease. We need to think about the patient, and we need to make sure that we're doing what is best for our patients. I also want to mention Alzheimer's is oftentimes mentioned as a target for stem cell therapy. Recent research demonstrates that Alzheimer's is actually a disease that is caused by reactivation of fetal genes that sort of eat up your neural synapses. This is a normal process during fetal development, right? We make a lot of neural synapses. We don't want to keep them all, so we have proteins that are made that degrade them. In Alzheimer's, for some reason, that fetal gene program is reactivated. So the last thing you would want to do to someone like Ronald Reagan is give him embryonic or fetal stem cells for that disease. So I'd like to jump ahead and really get to my point, which is what is best for the patient. So as a commercial scientist, when I look at this, I want a treatment that is safe, I want a treatment that is effective, and I want a treatment that is affordable. I'm sure that that's what everyone here in this room wants. So the question is, are pluripotent stem cells safe? No. Whether morally derived or not, they all form tumors in animals. Scientists like to call these non-malignant tumors. When we hear that word, we think, oh, that's a nice tumor. Well, it's not a nice tumor. It's not a metastatic tumor that spreads through your body. But if you get it in your brain or your heart or your kidneys or your liver or your pancreas, it's fatal. If you turn to the next page, this is just one publication showing a mouse heart that's been treated with embryonic stem cells and the tumor formation growing out of the heart. In all animal studies, when they give enough cells and they follow the animals long enough, tumor formation is 100%. And as a matter of fact, there are companies who commercially sell embryonic stem cells. Their quality control test is tumor formation. If their cells don't form tumors in an animal model, it's called a kidney capsule model, they are not pluripotent stem cells. They're not embryonic stem cells. This tumor formation is the very essence of these cells themselves. Are pluripotent stem cells effective? Pluripotent stem cells can be differentiated. Presumptive Dr. McGill mentioned this, to a differentiated cell type in the hopes of reducing the danger of tumor formation. Now, they can't be 100% differentiated. There's always the danger. Those cells do not differentiate into adult cells. They differentiate into neonatal cells. Those cells are not useful in the adult body, and they don't survive. On the next page is another publication where they had to use a cocktail of drugs and proteins to get those cells to survive. That is an economic nightmare and disaster and a regulatory nightmare and disaster, and I can assure you that won't get through the FDA, nor would you ever get the six companies who own the rights of those cocktails to collaborate on that. So are these cells affordable? The FDA approved the first embryonic stem cell clinical trial on January 22nd of 2009, and a biotech publication carried the story. Okay, this was going to be a slide presentation, and we didn't arrange it in time, so I apologize that the animation is on top. This is a quote from the CEO. He says, "This is going to be affordable. It won't be $500,000. So what is that, $490,000? Your bill estimates that 128 million Americans could benefit from these treatments. Now, if the U.S. Census Bureau is correct, there's less than 400 million Americans, so that's a lot of us with disease. That's a $64 trillion price tag. That's very expensive. In the same press release, they started lowering expectations. So before they got approval, they were going to cure everyone. Now they say, don't expect to get up and dance. Is that worth $490,000? And then they quote someone working in the field who says, the one thing that everybody hopes is that nothing bad happens. When we get a drug into clinical trials, the first trial is always for safety. We say things like, we hope we see a benefit. We hope we see an effect. These trials aren't designed to see a benefit. We never say, we hope nothing bad happens.
Perhaps that's a good place to stop, Dr. Deischer. If that's a good summary, we can take some questions. And I'm just looking at the clock here. We have a limited amount of time and a few more people would like to testify. So let me ask the committee if there are any questions for you. A case that will keep us all thinking. Thank you very much. Last on our list, Elise Brown. Shuffling papers here a little bit. Gary Whitman and Michael Wynn, please. Whitman, perhaps I misspoke. I apologize. Please. Mr. Whitman, maybe if you'd like to go first.
Okay. Chairman Reed, members of the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development, my name is Gary Whitman. My wife has Alzheimer's disease. I can tell you firsthand that Alzheimer's disease changes you and changes you completely. Dorothy changed from being lovable, likable, adorable, to being a real bitch. She's almost come full circle now, and she's back to being lovable once again. It's often said that Alzheimer's is harder on those that love the victim than it is on the victim themselves. In our case, I'm not so sure about that. Dorothy had a terrible time sorting out the lost memories amid the confusion and delusions. She would have what I often referred to as memory loss panic attacks. Sometimes during the evening, she would ask me to tell her what all we had done today, and I would go over it for her time and time and time again. When she could not remember much of any of it, she would start to panic, and that would build. She would get so panicky that she would ask me to take her to a hospital emergency room. I knew that wouldn't help, but she'd cloud my better judgment with statements such as, "You don't love me anymore." After three trips to emergency rooms, it seemed as though even she became convinced that wasn't helping. Home care didn't seem appropriate for us because Dorothy would have made the lives of three people extremely miserable: herself, any person that would come into the home, and me. Maybe I could have been more demanding about it, but it was the second marriage for both Dorothy and I, but with the blessings of her family and the support of my own family, I placed her in a care facility. She went into what was then St. Aidan's Place and is now Pacific Gardens, in October of 2005. It's tough placing someone you love in the care of others when they don't want any part of it. Unfortunately, Dorothy had behavior problems at the care facility. She was deemed a safety hazard, and she got evicted twice. Both times, the management called 911. An emergency vehicle came to take her to Providence Hospital emergency room. For both times, she stayed overnight, and the next day got placed at the Tuolumne Center for Psychiatric Care in Forest Grove. I know that what they do at Tuolumne is needed, and what they do well. Nonetheless, I hate the place. Dorothy's beyond being a safety hazard now, and I doubt that she'll be making any more visits to Tuolumne. We were lucky in that both Dorothy and I had taken out long-term care insurance, insurance that she wanted to cancel every time the premium came due. But on that, I persevered. However, we only took out two-year coverage. I used to think we were quite wealthy, but our wealth's not going to last forever, and she will eventually probably have to go on Medicaid. The total cost of her being at Pacific Gardens now totals about $190,000. That's the 3.5 years she's been there, of which John Hancock Financial paid about $110,000, and we have paid about $80,000. I give you these costs because I want to reinforce on you how expensive this disease is. I also couldn't help but note that this $190,000 is more than that's specified in Section 14 of this bill, which allocates money for administrative support. The staff at Pacific Gardens have been wonderful to me. I visit once each week, usually on Thursday, for the sing-along. I go more often, but my departures are very upsetting to Dorothy. I go to their support group meetings at Pacific Gardens, and I also attend the Hollywood Senior Center support group meetings. And sometimes I lead that one when our fearless leader is away on one of her many travel escapes. Lisa Clark, the administrator at Pacific Gardens, made a request of me, and that is to tell you that the increase in Medicaid reimbursements recently made law is appreciated. I think that was done during the, and I don't think we're supposed to refer to it as a special session, but emergency session or whatever. For me, the event of the year is the annual Alzheimer's Association Memory Walk. I'd like to invite everyone here to join us if you can. This year, the Portland Walk will be held on September 27th, and that's a Sunday. Starts at Pioneer Square at 10 a.m. Band Eugene and Medford also have memory walks. In summary, I urge passage of HB 2598 to make Oregon another state that supports stem cell research in the hope that in the future, people with spinal cord injuries, type 1 diabetes, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and other diseases may have a brighter future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitman. We really appreciate you being here. Dr. Nguyen?
Thank you, Chair Reed, and Vice Chair Glizio, Vice Chair Benz, for having me speak. I'm a neurologist here in Salem, and I'm going to shorten my comments significantly here.
Thank you. And if you wouldn't mind stating your name just for the record.
Oh, Michael Wynn.
Sorry, very much.
Michael Wynn, Dr. Michael Wynn, neurologist in Salem. Thanks to all the committee. This is a tough issue. It requires, I know every issue you're dealing with these days in our challenging times are very complex. This issue is unique because, as you've already heard, it takes some understanding, some complex science. So I'm going to kind of limit my comments to kind of a reiteration of some definitions of what's going on with the biology of this, and then talk a little bit about dollars and cents, actually. Let me just start with saying, well, I testified in favor of a bill in 2007, and as I listened to that testimony of other citizens and of the representatives in that committee, there was clearly some misperception on some key issues about this type of research. So I'm going to talk a little bit about adult and embryonic stem cells very briefly, one paragraph each. Adult stem cells are profoundly different than embryonic stem cells. Each of those has advantages and disadvantages to studying those. Each has strengths and weaknesses. So any effort to have stem cell research in Oregon needs to be a comprehensive stem cell research plan. Going in studying only one, let's just say adult stem cells, is like going into battle with one hand tied behind your back. Adult stem cells are found in specific organs, liver, pancreas, brain. You've already heard that. They are generally programmed naturally to make more cells of that organ. They have limited ability to form other types of cells. Adult stem cells are difficult to grow in the laboratory. As you've already heard, much of this research requires large populations of these cells. Adult stem cells are very tough to do that in a laboratory setting. Now, embryonic stem cells, on the other hand, are obtained from eggs, you've heard this, 4 or 5 days old. And let me just repeat this. This is a fertilized egg, 4 or 5 days old. Every cell in that egg is the same. There are no organs. There's no pancreas, no brain, no liver. They're all the same. We talk about, there's concerns have been made about killing these embryos, these 4 to 5 day fertilized eggs. Society has already made that decision. In fertility clinics across this country, in this state, blastocysts, fertilized eggs, 4 or 5 days old, are thrown away all the time. Society's already made a decision about how to deal with that. So those cells, embryonic stem cells, they can develop into any cell in our body, as we've already heard. They are actually relatively easily cultivated in the laboratory. That's why there are lines that are multiple years old, even though those lines do start to lose their value. That's not happened with adult stem cells. So embryonic stem cells have a strength that's very significant. Their genetic cell division apparatus is much different than an adult stem cell, because remember, they're going to form every cell. So one way to think about embryonic stem cells, one advantage, or strength, is that what happens in cancer is you have cells dividing unpredictably or without control. Embryonic stem cells have genetic switches and apparatuses that allow them to divide very rapidly. So the study of cancer can be advanced uniquely through the study of embryonic stem cells. Okay? So those are just a few differences between adult and embryonic stem cells. It's a false comparison to say that we can get by just fine studying one or the other. We'll be limited in them. A couple thoughts, and I'll finish in 2 minutes, about the dollars. The economic benefit of any new knowledge is proportional to society's need for that knowledge. And we all know that needs and wants can be a little bit gray zone sometimes. I think the need can be determined on a human emotional basis and in addition to a strict dollar profit basis. Now, clearly, if OHSU in Portland or Salem Hospital participates in a trial, or Corvallis or Eugene, if they come up with a new diagnostic test or treatment or cure based upon comprehensive stem cell research on Alzheimer's disease, which, by the way, is a multifactorial illness, it is an unfortunate simplification to say it's caused by a simple, single process, as was mentioned earlier. It's a very complex disease process. Anyway, if these institutions come up with an advance for these very expensive diseases, you can imagine people will pay to have that test or that treatment. How about the dollar profit concept of need? This society spends an astounding amount of money on these diseases. If OSU comes up with a solution or a partial solution to any of these diseases, there will be a very significant payoff for that institution. What's the dollars? Also, this data in this last few sentences comes from the national websites of the NIH and the national associations of these diseases. This country is spending $100 billion a year on Alzheimer's disease. Medicare costs alone are estimated to be $190 billion in 2010. That's just around the corner. The lifetime cost per case of MS, many patients with MS are diagnosed at a young age, is $2.2 million per case. The Oregon MS Society estimates that there are 6,500 cases in Oregon. That's big numbers if you do that math. Oregon cannot afford to continue to spend these kind of dollars on just one disease. Stroke is the leading cause of disability. That's $50 billion a year. I mean, the billions just start rolling off the tongue too easily here, but you get the idea. So in light of this, in light of these astounding amount of dollars we're spending on these diseases, when someone comes up with an advance, that is going to bring in significant profit, frankly, to that institution, private or public, in this state. So as we've heard so eloquently, we can't begin to quantify the human cost of these diseases, but the economic cost and the benefit is remarkable for institutions that come up with solutions. And again, I guess I'll just stop at this. We've heard a few times that, well, we haven't had any great successes with embryonic stem cell research, so why are we going to do that? You know, we don't have a car that can get 100 miles a gallon, so should we stop looking? Another reason why we haven't had too many astounding successes with embryonic stem cell research is because we haven't been doing it in this country very much in the last 8 to 10 years. When you don't look into something or you don't have the full array of tools to investigate an area, you're right. You're not going to make a whole lot of progress. All the more reason to support this bill to make progress in the state of Oregon. So this train is leaving the station. If this research isn't done in Portland, Eugene, or Corvallis, or Salem, it'll be done in Hartford, or London, or Beijing, or the Netherlands, where they're being done right now. So I think Oregon is a pioneering state. We have a great entrepreneurial history, and I encourage support of this bill as it is written so that we can unleash the pioneering and entrepreneurial spirit of Oregon business and science. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Nguyen. Ms. Brown, I have to beg your apologies. I'm wondering, since we see you in the building pretty frequently, whether you might be amenable to coming back on Thursday, and we might use our very limited remaining time for questions for Dr. Nguyen. Would that offend you terribly?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm happy to do that. I was going to say I'm the little caboose here at the end, but I'll save my talking points for Thursday.
Thank you very much for your flexibility. Other questions? Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Dr. Nguyen, but I was wondering if I might start with a question for our chief sponsor,
Health Freeman.
Representative, is it correct to say that your bill does not differentiate between adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells in the funding mechanism?
Yes, it's a comprehensive approach. So it doesn't make... Yes, this is the short answer to that question. Yeah.
Thank you. Dr. Nguyen, your testimony, I thought, was very interesting. Is there a capacity within the research community, and not being a researcher or really, frankly, having the capacity to understand or make a differentiation between adult and embryonic stem cells, is there a capacity within the research community to take these dollars, to innovate along these different lines, and then have the research community decide what's the most effective avenue for research?
Oh, sure. I mean, this happens all the time in science. I mean, my training was at OHSU, and then I did a fellowship in stroke, and that's what happens. See, well, let's investigate path A, and you go down that road a little ways, and you realize, you know what, we're not making progress. Stop. Move on to a different path. But you've got to investigate it first. You have to look down the way. So, yes, there is. That happens all the time. In fact, for grant proposals, research proposals, as our presumptive doctor knows, I love that term, people review your work. And they say, Dr. Nguyen, what are you doing with this? Where are you going? You're challenged all the time to justify what you're doing. That's a very vigorous debate in every institution.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I wanted to ask you a question. Before I do, I appreciate our vice chair and our chair setting a tone of respect. So with respect, we have a big disagreement. And I'd like you to just articulate a little more the basis for your statement that society has already decided, has already made the leap regarding embryonic stem cells.
Thank you. I wrote that down about 10 minutes ago, so that's a quick thing. So here's the deal. People say, and I actually take some issue with the choice of words. Words really do count. Killing humans. That's what happens when people dispose of blastocysts, 4 or 5 day old fertilized eggs. I just that's already happening, because I guess it's presented as we can't go down this line because who would want to do that? Well, no one would want to do that. Society has already said fertility clinics nationwide. They'll fertilize in vitro a number of eggs, and then they don't keep them all, so they are disposed of. Now, I don't consider that murder at all, which brings up another very important issue. I actually think that equating a five-day-old fertilized egg with anybody in this room diminishes the humanity of everybody in this room. A five-day-old egg cannot argue, create, love, debate, anything. So humans are much, much more than a collection of cells. And a five-day-old fertilized egg, it has potential. We all know that. It's a miracle in its own way, of course. So I don't want to talk down that, but I think it's just a false comparison.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, the basis for that statement on your part is largely because laboratories in vitro type are already disposing of in their work. Disposing of in
It's been happening for years nationwide.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Representative, if you had a very quick one, I'm just noticing that our successors in this room are starting to come in, so we're going to wrap it up quickly. And we have more time on Thursday.
I can let it pass.
Dr. Nguyen, I didn't realize you were a Salemite, so if you have the availability on Thursday, we'd love to have you back. Ms. Brown will certainly have you. We appreciate the beginning of a good conversation. Appreciate especially the tone everyone exhibited. It was very helpful, and certainly feel like we were in science class today. So that's a nice
thank you.
Treat. Thank you all. We're adjourned. See you Thursday.
It's always like science class.